Chapter 5, Call to Action. When was the last time you walked around your organization to hear about the good, the bad, and the ugly of top-down management? Walking around and listening was my first step in preparing to command Santa Fe. December 16, 1998, onboard USS Santa Fe, Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. 24 days to change of command. According to procedure, I was to spend the next 2 weeks reviewing everything on the ship, including training records, school records, administrative records, award records, advancement records, records pertaining to the operation and maintenance of the reactor plant, the weapon system, the torpedoes and missiles, schedules, exercises, classified materials, and so on. I ignored that. Instead, I spent my time walking around the ship, talking to people. I also set up a series of walkabouts during which each chief or officer would walk with me around his spaces. In order to do these inspections properly, I'd ask them to bring me a flashlight. It wasn't supposed to be a test, but the flashlights were pitiful. Broken, dead batteries, dim bulbs, you couldn't see anything. I figured this was what Commodore Kenny was talking about. I got myself a super mag light that took 4 D-cell batteries. Its light was as bright as the sun. I carried that flashlight around with me everywhere. Soon, others started carrying flashlights that actually worked as well. I attended a department head meeting, a routine review of maintenance issues, in the wardroom. The wardroom is a small room in which there's a 10-man table where the officers eat. It also serves as a training room, an operational planning room, a meeting room, and the place where officers watch movies. If necessary, it serves as the surgical operating room as well. I looked around at the 4 department heads. These were the key individuals I would go to war with, entrust the lives of the 135 crew members to, and possibly die with. I felt bad for these guys. The attendees wandered in late, and the captain stayed away until everyone was assembled. Then he was invited. The meeting started late. It might seem like a little thing, but on board a nuclear submarine, little things like lack of punctuality are indicative of much, much bigger problems. At this particular meeting, everyone was waiting for someone else. The meeting started. Lieutenant Dave Adams, the weapons officer, briefed the problem with the vertical launch system in the bow of the sub. There was a long discussion about O-ring seals and retests. I probably should have paid attention to the technical issues because this missile system wasn't on the Olympia, so I hadn't paid attention to it during my training. But instead, I observed the people in the room. Dave was earnest and forthright, but frustrated and defensive about all the questions he needed to answer. The other department heads and chiefs were bored. After the meeting, I followed Dave to his stateroom. "Weps, you seem a bit frustrated." "Look, Captain, I have a vision of how I want this department to operate," he began. As I listened to him tell me about how he wanted things to be, I became more and more enthusiastic and impressed. Unfortunately, he was being ignored. As he ticked through the ideas he had for improving his department, I would ask how he had implemented them. Each time the answer was the same. Someone up the chain of command hadn't supported the initiative, so nothing happened. The chiefs working for him didn't seem eager to step up with their own ideas either. He had wanted to conduct training with the officers numerous times on Tomahawk missile strikes, something we would be tested on in January, but the training either had never been scheduled or had been canceled. In essence, Dave was describing a problem inherent in the leader-follower model, although he didn't use those words. Because of his insights and passion, he would become one of Santa Fe's greatest engines for good, embracing the concept of leader-leader and carrying it forward. I found Dave an incredibly intelligent, driven, and gifted officer. He grew up the younger son of a career Army enlisted man. Likely influenced by his demanding father, Dave acquired a drive I've rarely seen equaled. He also learned to appreciate his men, but at the same time, demand excellence from them. I felt better about my plan because I was going to have to rely on the technical expertise of Dave and the other department heads if it was going to work. Dave wasn't the only frustrated officer. Lieutenant Commander Bill Green, the navigator, and senior department head had requested a transfer out of the submarine force. Two of the junior officers had submitted their resignations. As things on Santa Fe deteriorated, the crew adopted a hunker-down mode in which avoiding mistakes became the primary drive for all actions. They focused exclusively on satisfying the minimum requirements. Anything beyond that was ignored. During one of my walkabouts, I noted that one junior sailor looked particularly forlorn. When I pressed him on how he was doing, he told me he wasn't sure he was going to get home to the mainland for Christmas because his leave chit wasn't back yet. Turns out he'd submitted it weeks earlier and the holiday break was coming soon. He hadn't bought airline tickets yet since he didn't know if his leave would be approved, and now, this late, the tickets were bound to be expensive if they were even available. The Standard Submarine Organization and Regulations Manual states that the executive officer will sign all enlisted leave chits and the commanding officer all officer leave chits. Since we enforce the chain of command, that means that a leave chit from a junior sailor must go through his leading first-class petty officer, divisional chief, department chief, chief of the boat, division officer, department head, and finally the executive officer. 7 people. The form had only 5 lines for signature, so we were using rulers to half-split some of the lines so everyone could sign. We had done this sailor wrong. I rushed about, tracking down his leave chit. It was sitting in someone's inbox, and took care of it. It was the system, not the people, that failed, however. Once I had acquainted myself with my men, I devoted time to observing some of the ship's routines. One morning I was talking to the engineer, Lieutenant Commander Rick Panlilio, when the radioman arrived with the message board. In those days, we took all the naval messages that came to the ship each day, there might be 30 or 40, printed them out, and routed them on a clipboard with a routing stamp. The stamp had a spot for each person to initial, indicating he had seen the messages. Some messages were general and administrative, announcing courses or changes in requirements for paperwork or updates to manuals. Some messages were materiel, reporting changes in maintenance procedures or requesting data on a particular valve if made by a particular company. Some messages were operational, providing direction for the ship's schedule, assigning navigational water space, and tasking for the ship's operations. Rick flipped through the sheets of paper and was visibly aggravated. "Here, look at this," he said. "By protocol, the messages are first routed to the captain, then to the executive officer, and down to the chain of command. This way, the captain would be the first to know of any changes in the ship's schedule. It is how we controlled the information." The message board had already been to the captain and the executive officer. Many of the messages had notes on them from one or both. Things like, "Enter this message change in the publication," or, "I want to report back on this by Friday." Rick looked downcast. "See, this message is an urgent change to a publication. You don't think we know that we're supposed to enter the change? I'm getting told to do stuff even before I know I have stuff to do." "Why do you think the captain and executive officer feel they need to write those things?" "Well, look, I may be wrong, but let's say something doesn't happen. Some report does not get sent, or a school date changes and we don't catch it, and some inspection team is looking at the records. The captain can say, 'I told him to do it,' and bully for him. He gets good marks for being very involved, having his fingerprints everywhere. But from my perspective, it's not helpful. It actually hurts. Not only are they telling me to do stuff I already know I have to do, but also frequently I get told exactly how and when to do it. That takes away any decision-making opportunities I might have." As was the case with the message board, like every other submarine, Santa Fe had quarters on the pier a couple times a week. This was a morning formation with the crew standing behind their chiefs and officers in a square. The commanding officer, executive officer, and chief of the boat, the senior enlisted man known as the Cobb, were in the middle and made announcements. On the day I'm describing, we conducted an award ceremony. It was great to see some sailors getting well-deserved recognition. The awards were for people leaving the ship or for the previous upkeep. Unfortunately, no wives had been invited to attend, and there was no photographer, so he lost the chance to promote these accomplishments in front of a wider audience. There was a last-minute scramble to assemble the citations and medals. We welcomed new crew members and bid aloha to departing ones. The captain seemed unfamiliar with the details about the men, where they had come from, where they were going. As the formation went on, I wandered around the periphery. Standing in the back, where most of the crew was, I couldn't make out anything the captain said. His words were muted and garbled. I asked one of the crew members if he could hear. "No, but it didn't matter," he said. If there was something important, the chief would tell him at divisional quarters, a meeting that followed this meeting. With leader-follower, it didn't matter. The overwhelming sense on the ship was that we needed to avoid problems, avoid drunken driving citations, avoid liberty incidents, avoid physical fitness failures, avoid tag-out errors, avoid rework, and avoid a reactor problem. Still, there was a spark, a desire to do well despite all these frustrations. It was clear to me that whereas the Olympia crew wasn't as good as they thought they were, the Santa Fe crew wasn't as bad as they thought they were. There was a thirst to do better and an eagerness for change. I felt the crew's pain and frustration in a physical way. When I arrived in the morning, my stomach was in knots as I anticipated finding out about some new way the crew's time was being wasted and their talents ignored. At the same time, I knew that their pain and frustration were providing me with a tremendous call to action. There would be an eagerness to change the way we were doing business that I could tap into. I resolved that we would turn everything on its head. I'd try the initiatives I had tried unsuccessfully on Will Rogers. I went back to Commodore Kenny and I told him I could definitely work with this. We would deploy on time. Questions to consider. Is there a call to action in your organization? Do people want to change, or are they comfortable with the current level of performance? Are things too comfortable? Is there a feeling of complacency? Do people take action to protect themselves or to make the outcome better? Does leadership in your organization take control or give control? Chapter 6. Whatever they tell me to do. What goes on in your workplace every day that reinforces the notion that the guys at the top are the leaders and everyone else is simply to follow? I was startled to find this was pervasive on Santa Fe. December 26th, 1998, on board USS Santa Fe, Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, 14 days to change of command. It was a quiet day over Christmas break. Only a skeleton watch section remained on board, and they were not doing any maintenance. The men were just taking logs and completing daily routines like loading potable water and pumping the sanitary tanks. I wandered about the ship with my flashlight and made my way to the engine room. En route, I passed the maneuvering room, which is the control room for the reactor and the propulsion plant. Formality here is to be stressed at all times. All personnel must ask permission to enter. It doesn't matter how senior you are, even admirals have to ask to be admitted. To be informal in the maneuvering room is detrimental to the safe operation of the ship and is thus a big taboo. I recalled the photo I had seen during prospective commanding officer training that showed a bunch of shaggy-looking guys. They weren't just informal, they were cracking up. To make matters worse, this picture had gone around the internet, and you could see in the background some of the dials and instruments for the reactor plant. The point of showing us the photograph during prospective commanding officer training was to demonstrate how bad things could get without proper enforcement of standards. And yes, the guys in the photo were crewmen on board Santa Fe. I recognized some of the watch standards from the picture. I wondered if they knew how famous, or infamous, they were. Probably not. I stopped to chat with a first class petty officer on watch in the engine room. First class petty officers are one rank below chief. They are the workhorses of the Navy, doing a tremendous amount of watch standing, hands-on maintenance, as well as training of the junior enlisted men. They are considered to be budding leaders. "Hi, what do you do on board?" By asking open-ended questions like this, I could better gauge what the crew thought their job was. "Whatever they tell me to do," he immediately replied with unmistakable cynicism. He knew he was a follower, and not happy with it, but he also was not taking responsibility. He was throwing it back in my face that the command was all screwed up. It was a stunningly insulting thing to say, yet a brilliantly clear description of the problem. I should have been irate. Instead, I felt strangely detached, like a scientific observer. Whatever they tell me to do, that was the attitude all over the ship. I began to see things in a new light. Whatever they tell me to do. Toward the end of one day, I was sitting with the executive officer in his stateroom. Lieutenant Commander Bill Green, the navigator, came in and asked the executive officer if he had anything more for him that day. The executive officer, who was caught off guard by this question, said no, and Bill headed home. Bill was, like everyone else on board, ready to do whatever he was told. This was a show for me. I asked the executive officer if checking out was normal practice. In a proud voice, he told me that he liked the department heads to check out with him so he could go over what they owed and make sure that they didn't go home with a significant issue open. But, he admitted, they didn't always do it. I subsequently went over this end-of-day checkout event in detail with all the officers. The problem, I explained, was that in this scenario, the executive officer is the one who was responsible for each department head's work, not the department head himself. Psychological ownership for accomplishing the work rested with the executive officer, not the department head. Checking out is fine, I said, but it should go more like this. XO, I'm shoving off for the day. The charts for next week's underway are coming along fine, and we'll be able to show the rough plan to the captain tomorrow. I wasn't able to see Petty Officer Smith for his qualification interview, but we'll be able to make that up tomorrow. In this scenario, it is the department head, not the executive officer, who is responsible for the department head's job. This is leadership at all levels. The department heads identified a potential problem with this approach. Who would be responsible and accountable for the work? If you, the captain, allow us to make decisions about the work, aren't you risking your professional reputation and career on how well we do? Isn't that the reason these ideas are so hard to implement? They had a point. I pondered that. Would I be willing to be vulnerable to the effects of their decisions? On a submarine, a warship, there were lives at stake after all, not just our careers. I would retain accountability for Santa Fe's operational performance, but release control of the actual decisions to the department heads. It felt uncomfortable, but we were in such a bind that I didn't see any other way. Besides, Santa Fe was already at the bottom. How much worse could the ship do? By contrast, whatever they tell me to do pointed to the reality that the fundamental structure of leader-follower was the problem on board ship. Everyone below the captain and the department heads had their brains shut off. What did that give us? We had 135 men on board and only 5 of them fully engaged their capacity to observe, analyze, and problem solve. An image from my hometown popped into my head. I grew up in Concord, Massachusetts, near Lowell, where a host of empty textile mills marked the landscape. This is how I pictured the mental utilization of the crew, sitting idle. Another thing bothered me as well. Who exactly was the they in the statement, whatever they tell me to do? Wasn't they us? Once I understood the pervasive influence that our structure of leader-follower had on our way of doing business, I saw examples of it everywhere I looked, in the way we conducted operations, the end-of-day checkout, the structure of the meetings, the routing of the message boards, the quarters on the pier. Everything we did reinforced the notion that the guys at the top were the leaders and the rest of the crew were the followers. The problem for Santa Fe wasn't an absence of leadership. It was too much leadership of the wrong kind, the leader-follower kind. I could also see the cost of leader-follower in the passivity of the sailors at quarters, in the lack of initiative, in the waiting for others, in the department head's paralysis without the commanding officer at the department head meetings. Everything would have to change. Questions to consider. Why is doing what you are told appealing to some? Do people really just want to do as they are told? If a snapshot of your business went viral on the internet, what would it reveal about your workers? Do your procedures reinforce the leader-follower model? How would your middle managers react if you implemented a checkout system like the one described in this chapter? Chapter 7, I Relieve You. Is your organization spending more energy trying to avoid errors than achieving excellence? We were. January 8, 1999. Submarine Base, Pearl Harbor. 172 days to deployment. Freshly painted, Santa Fe sat proudly next to the pier at Submarine Base, Pearl Harbor. The January weather was beautiful, sunny, 75 degrees, and light trade winds. On board the ship, a portable platform had been loaded with a podium and four chairs. I was sitting in the second chair, looking across to the pier where the families, crew, and submarine community of Pearl Harbor were sitting under tents. In a few minutes, I would be taking command of a nuclear-powered submarine and instantly become responsible for the taxpayers' $2 billion investment and 135 men. I would be responsible for preparing the warship to take the fight to the enemy and return home. It was a daunting task. It had come faster than I could have imagined, and I certainly didn't feel ready. The authorities and responsibilities of the commanding officer, or captain, are specified in U.S. Navy regulations. The responsibility of the commanding officer for his or her command is absolute, while the commanding officer may, at his or her discretion, and when not contrary to law or regulations, delegate authority to subordinates for the execution of details, such delegation of authority shall in no way relieve the commanding officer of continued responsibility for the safety, well-being, and efficiency of the entire command, Section 0802. Delegation is the exception, not the rule. This issue of absolute responsibility has been a fundamental aspect of naval service since the United States Navy was crafted in the image of the Royal Navy. If the ship started to sink right at that moment, I would not be responsible. If it started to sink in an hour, it would be my responsibility 100%. I would be accountable. While that singular point of accountability is attractive in many ways, there is a downside. The previous commanding officer would not be held accountable. Thus, as I pointed out earlier, each commanding officer is encouraged to maximize performance for his tour and his tour alone. There is no incentive or reward for developing mechanisms that enable excellence beyond your immediate tour. Imagine the impact of this on the thousands of decisions made by the commanding officers throughout the Navy. For example, in Section 0851 in the Navy Regulations on Action with the Enemy, the commanding officer is directed to take the following action. Before going into battle or action, communicate to the officers of the command, if possible, his or her plans for battle or action, and such other information as may be of operational value should any of them succeed to command. It might seem amazing that we feel it necessary to tell commanding officers to communicate the battle plan to their subordinates before going into combat, if possible. If the crew doesn't know and understand the battle plan before then, defeat is almost certain. But those Navy regs are describing the top-down, aloof, leader-follower structure that naval officers learn. Leader-follower is the image that comes to mind when we think of the confident, resolute commanding officer boldly leading his crew into battle. We think this is good leadership. As I sat there on the dais, musing about what I would soon be accountable for, I thought back to my introduction to Santa Fe and took stock of what we had going for us. First, the crew wanted change, even if they didn't know quite how to do it. When I asked the men what I shouldn't change, what worked particularly well, I didn't get a lot of answers. The frustration, wasted hours, and mediocre results of the previous year had convinced them they needed to do something else. Ultimately, we were to introduce a new way of doing business that would be different from what they'd experienced before and would spare them the pain they'd suffered earlier on board. Without the thirst for change, it would have been difficult to get the crew to accept an entirely new way of thinking about leadership. This call to action would be necessary for the changes I had in mind. Second, we had an incredibly supportive chain of command. My bosses, Commodore Mark Kenny and Rear Admiral Al Konecny, Commander Submarine Forces Pacific, Com Sub Pac, were ready to give me all the encouragement I needed and all the rope I needed to hang myself. They were outcome-focused. They didn't care or need to know the specifics of what we were going to do as long as the evidence showed that the submarine was improving in performance, warfighting capability, and morale. This was good, because I'm not sure I could have articulated the path ahead, and even if I had, I'm not sure they would have bought it. Third, my reliance on the crew for the specifics of how the boat operated prevented me from falling into old habits and the trap of leader-follower. I couldn't have operated that way if I'd wanted to. There were many times I had the impulse to give specific direction, but I couldn't. Although I cursed my lack of technical knowledge, it prevented me from falling back on bad habits. In the past, when I would interview a crew member about how something worked, I only acted curious because, in reality, I knew how it worked. Now, when I talked to the men on the ship, I actually was curious. Finally, it seemed clear that the crew was in a self-reinforcing downward spiral where poor practices resulted in mistakes, mistakes resulted in poor morale, and poor morale resulted in avoiding initiative and going into survival mode of doing only what was absolutely necessary. In order to break this cycle, I'd need to radically change the daily motivation by shifting the focus from avoiding errors to achieving excellence. Mechanism: achieve excellence, don't just avoid errors. In the nuclear-powered submarine Navy, we focus on errors. We track them, we report them, and we attempt to understand the reasons for them. There is a powerful and effective culture of open and honest discussion about what went wrong and what could have gone better. What happens then is that we evaluate ships based on the mistakes they make. Avoiding mistakes becomes the prime focus of the crew and leadership. What happened with Santa Fe, however, was that the crew was becoming gun-shy about making mistakes. The best way not to make a mistake is not to do anything or make any decisions. It dawned on me the day I assumed command that focusing on avoiding errors is helpful for understanding the mechanics of procedures and detecting impending major problems before they occur, but it is a debilitating approach when adopted as the objective of an organization. You are destined to fail. No matter how good you get at avoiding mistakes, you will always have errors on something as complex as a submarine. You might reduce the number and severity, but there will never be zero. They may be such minor errors as reading a gauge wrong or scheduling two conflicting events, but people always make mistakes. Thus, they always feel bad about themselves. In the same vein, success is a negative, an absence of failure, avoidance of a critique or an incident. Sadly, a common joke on Santa Fe was, "Your reward is no punishment." I resolved to change this. Our goal would be excellence instead of error reduction. We would focus on exceptional operational effectiveness for the submarine. We would achieve great things. Part of achieving excellence would be acquiring an intimate understanding of errors, that is, what caused them and what we needed to do to eliminate them. But that intimate understanding would not be the thing the crew needed to be thinking about as they reported for duty. Reducing mistakes would be an important side benefit to attaining our primary goal, achieving excellence. Excellence was going to be more than a philosophical statement pasted to the bulkhead. It was going to be how we lived, ate, and slept. My thoughts turned sharply back to the present. I heard the outgoing commanding officer come to the end of his speech. I stood, and with the words, "I relieve you," became the commanding officer of Santa Fe. I turned to Commodore Kenny and reported I had relieved as Commanding Officer Santa Fe. I was now totally accountable for Santa Fe and committed myself to that role with the following words. I believe the personal freedoms, respect for human dignity, and economic prosperity we enjoy in the United States are unique throughout the history of mankind and across the span of the globe. I believe that this is not the natural state, but one which must be worked for relentlessly and, if necessary, defended. I believe the men who sallied forth from these very piers and boats like Tang, Wahoo, and Barb were engaged in an honorable and worthwhile endeavor. I believe those eternally on patrol beyond the reef did not die in vain. The future depends upon those willing to continue that honorable and worthwhile endeavor. Accordingly, I reaffirm my vow to defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Shipmates of Santa Fe, I will be proud to sail with you. Thank you. I sat down. I was ready to go to work. We were scheduled to deploy in 172 days. As I looked across at the officers, chiefs, and sailors assembled on the pier, I knew we should start in the middle. We would start with the chiefs. Going to sea in a submarine, leaving your family for 6 months, is hard work. Honorable work, but hard work. These guys weren't going to become rich, looting enemy ships. They weren't in it for themselves. Fear was pervasive, and we needed to turn that around. Connecting our day-to-day activities to something larger was a strong motivator for the crew. The connection was there, but it had been lost. Instead, in ways large and small, I encountered situations where the crew's actions were motivated by following a checklist, pleasing an inspector, looking good, or some other variant of, quote, avoiding problems. We needed everyone to see the ultimate purpose for the submarine and remember that it was a noble purpose. I also wanted to connect our current endeavors with the submarine force's rich legacy of service to and sacrifice for the country. Once the crewmen remembered what we were doing and why, they would do anything to support the mission. This was a stark contrast to earlier, when people were coming to work simply with the hope of not screwing up. Achieve excellence, don't avoid errors is a mechanism for clarity. The book to read is Simon Sinek's Start With Why. Questions to consider. Are your people trying to achieve excellence or just to avoid making mistakes? Has your organization become action adverse because taking action sometimes results in errors? Have you let error reduction programs sap the lifeblood out of initiative and risk-taking? Do you spend more time critiquing errors than celebrating success? Are you able to identify the symptoms of avoiding errors in your workplace? When you ask people what their jobs are, do they answer in terms of reducing errors? When you investigate the criteria that went behind decisions, do you find that avoidance of negative outcomes far outweighs accomplishing positive outcomes? What is the primary motivation of the middle managers and rank and file, not what it says on the wall poster outside the boardroom? How do you minimize errors but not make that the focus of your organization? Part 2. Control. My primary focus when I assumed command of Santa Fe was to divest control and distribute it to the officers and crew. Control is about making decisions concerning not only how we are going to work, but also toward what end. A submarine has a built-in structure whereby information is channeled up the chain of command to decision makers. Instead, we were going to deconstruct decision authority and push it down to where the information lived. We called this, don't move information to authority, move authority to the information. The chapters in this part will introduce you to the initial set of mechanisms we devised to implement leader-leader. The chapters in this part will introduce you to the initial set of mechanisms we devised to implement leader-leader practices. I've organized the mechanisms into three groups: control, competence, and clarity. Although the initial focus was on redistributing control, it was necessary to work in all three areas. Find the genetic code for control and rewrite it. Act your way to new thinking. Short, early conversations make efficient work. Use "I intend to" turn passive followers into active leaders. Resist the urge to provide solutions. Eliminate top-down monitoring systems. Think out loud, both superiors and subordinates. Embrace the inspectors. Chapter 8. Change in a word. What's the best way to change decision-making authorities in your organization? Turns out it's pretty easy once you commit to changing. January 8, 1999, Old Periscope Facility, Submarine Base, Pearl Harbor, 172 days to deployment. Later that afternoon, I sat with the chiefs of Santa Fe in the defunct World War II Periscope Repair Facility. Now a tired and unassuming two-story building next to the piers, this structure had once been a constant scene of activity as technicians worked to refurbish and focus the periscopes of American submarines. These were the tools that such men as Dick O'Kane, Mush Morton, and Gene Flucky would use to achieve victory against the Empire of Japan. The periscope repair functions had moved to a larger and more up-to-date facility 100 yards away, and the original facility was now an informal lounge. The room was hot and uncomfortable. We sat on recycled furniture with a squeaky ceiling fan turning slowly above us, and the windows opened to let in the slight breeze. If I started at the top, the executive officer, chief of the boat, and department heads, we would be using a top-down approach to implement a bottom-up leadership philosophy. That was inherently contradictory. Additionally, that would involve only 6 people and wouldn't create a critical mass of participation. The junior officers weren't a good place to start because they had lost credibility in the command and would still have to learn the basics of leadership. Starting at the bottom with the junior enlisted men probably wouldn't work either. There was too much distance between them and me, and without support in the rest of the command, they would be viewed suspiciously. So here I was with the chiefs. I had suffered through many wasted hours listening to lectures about how we should work together, take initiative, and the like. These weren't backed up with mechanisms that actually enabled or rewarded these behaviors, so the speeches were worse than nothing at all. They sounded hypocritical and the speakers out of touch. I was resolved to avoid this altogether. Instead of trying to change mindsets and then change the way we acted, we would start acting differently and the new thinking would follow, or so I'd hoped. Besides, we didn't have time for a long gestation period. We needed change now. I wasn't 100% sure that the chiefs would bite. I was confident in the support of the chief of the boat. As the senior enlisted man, he was organizationally committed to supporting me. I was less confident about the rest. I was sorry that Senior Chief Andy Warshak, the senior sonarman and weapons department chief, was on leave. I knew he would have been an ally. I looked around. Chief John Larson, an electronics technician, sat opposite me. He had struck me as thoughtful and eager to learn. Chief Brad Jensen, the senior nuclear chief, we called him the Bull Nuke, and his nuke chief sat together. They'd likely be on board. I was glad to see Chief David Steele in the group. After our earlier conversation, he had gone home and talked to his wife. They agreed to give the new command a chance, and he withdrew his transfer request. His positive nodding was already influencing the men around him in a good way as the meeting began. My flashlight was superfluous, but I had brought it anyway. Brandishing it, I opened with a question. "Men, we say the chiefs run the Navy. Is this true on Santa Fe?" Reflexively, they answered, "Yes, of course." "Really?" "Well," came the second round of answers, as most of them looked at the floor. Apparently not so much on Santa Fe. They were right. The chiefs did not run the Navy, and they did not run the Santa Fe. The reasons for this were both institutional and human. The institutional problem was that the desire to have the commanding officer uniquely and completely accountable for the ship ran counter to allowing the chiefs the authority to manage things. Admiral Hyman Rickover and the nuclear-powered Navy implemented a highly successful program with an unparalleled safety record. From an organizational perspective, the accountability of the commanding officers was heavily stressed. Their selection and training were incredibly important. The department heads approved operations, and the department head or captain authorized maintenance. A long list of activities and evolutions could be performed only with the specific permission of the commanding officer, and so on. These practices reinforced leader-follower in the submarine force. As a result, the performance of the submarines was directly coupled with the technical ability of the commanding officer. As I've already mentioned, some ships would do well under one commanding officer, and then poorly under the next. At the same time, the Naval Nuclear Propulsion Program had succeeded in developing an alternative to the personality-centered leadership approach, a procedurally-centered leadership structure in which the procedure reigns supreme. This structure is effective when it comes to operating a nuclear reactor. The system is well-defined and predictable. People are highly trained, and the operators follow the procedure. Actually, as a citizen of the planet, you want this procedurally centered leadership when it comes to operating the reactor plant. The range of potential conditions and responses is bounded. It is when operators don't follow procedures that very unpredictable and typically bad things happen. At the same time, the Naval Nuclear Propulsion Program has succeeded in developing an alternative to the personality-centered leadership approach, a procedurally centered leadership structure in which the procedure reigns supreme. Yet this emphasis on following the procedure can have a stultifying effect. We take bright operators, train them extensively, and then tell them that the most important thing is to follow the procedure. When it comes to operating a submarine against the enemy, the application of this procedurally centered approach is limiting, both in how the submarine is employed and in how the intellect of the operators is employed. Fundamentally, tactical operations of the submarine are different from reactor plant operations. Tactical operations are against an intelligent enemy who thinks, plots, and deliberately exploits weaknesses. The complexity is significantly higher. Strictly following procedures won't get us there. At this point, we fall back on the personality-centered leadership structure. In reversing years of the leader-follower system's erosion of the chief's authority, the chiefs on board Santa Fe, now under my command, would be going against the grain. I wanted to make sure they deliberately decided to take charge. It wouldn't be any good if I directed them. You can't invoke leader-follower rules to direct a shift from leader-follower to leader-leader. To say these guys were skeptical would be an understatement. Sure, they sensed that things could have been better, but, after all, Santa Fe hadn't had a collision, grounding, or truly significant incident. Was it performing that poorly? Furthermore, they'd been in the Navy for 15 years, on average, and it had always been this way on all their other submarines. Was it possible that a better way existed? My next question built on what we had all agreed on, namely, the chiefs did not run Santa Fe. I asked, "Do you want to?" Reflexively, they answered, "Yes, of course." "Really?" And that's when we began to talk honestly about what the chiefs running the submarine would mean. Mechanism: find the genetic code for control and rewrite it. Here is a list of the primary problems the chiefs struggled with: below average advancement rates for their men, a lengthy qualification program that yielded few qualified watchstanders, poor performance on evaluations for the ship, a lean watch bill with many watch stations port and starboard underway and 3-section in port. The objective was to have 3-section at sea and at least 4-section in port. This meant that each member would stand watch every third watch rotation, typically 6 hours on watch and 12 hours off at sea, and every fourth day in port. An inability to schedule, control, and commence work on time. An inability to control the schedules of their division and men. We talked about the reality that running Santa Fe would mean they would be accountable for the performance of their divisions. No more sitting in the cozy chief's quarters and letting the department head or division officer explain to the captain why things had gone wrong. Later, I would call this eyeball accountability. It meant being intimately involved, physically present in most cases, in the operations of the ship and in each activity. The chief's enthusiasm waned noticeably. Some could see this would change the way they would have to think about their position. Being the chief would no longer mean a position of privilege, but a position of accountability, responsibility, and work. Not everyone thought this would be better. We discussed this long and hard, but didn't waste time discussing the philosophy of the role of the chief petty officer in today's Navy or on exhortations and speeches. We didn't have time for those luxuries. At the end, we were agreed. The sole output would be concrete mechanisms. I was thinking about Jim Collins and Jerry Porras' book, Built to Last, and their discussion of how personalities come and go, but institutional mechanisms endure and embed the change in the organization. I put this question to Santa Fe's chiefs. What can we do so that you actually run the ship? First and foremost, the chiefs wanted to be in charge of their own men, and that meant putting them in charge of their men's leave. Some of the chiefs protested, claiming they were already in charge of their leave. But after the Cobb signed the leave chit, and he did so for every enlisted man, it still needed to be signed by 3 officers, the division officer, the department head, and the executive officer. The chiefs weren't in charge. The chiefs came up with a solution: could the Ka be the final signature authority for enlisted leave chits? It was brilliantly simple. Instead of making a 14-step process more efficient, 7 steps up through the enlisted chain of command and the chief of the boat to the division officer, department head, and executive officer, and 7 steps down, we would eliminate 6 of the steps. I just needed to cross out executive officer and write Cobb in the ship's regulations. A one-word change. That was the genetic code. That was what they were proposing. I was reluctant to agree for a couple of reasons. In my previous jobs, I had countermanded ill-thought-out leave plans from the chiefs. Knowing the officers above them would likely veto excessive leave plans and wanting to be the nice guys, the chiefs tended to say yes a lot. Additionally, I was concerned that the junior officers would lose the experience of learning personnel management and lose touch of their divisions. Finally, and perhaps most important, the commanding officer wasn't authorized to make this change. The submarine organization manual was a Navy document that we weren't supposed to change. We discussed some of these drawbacks, and the chiefs offered their solution. The chiefs would be responsible for the performance of their divisions and all that encompassed. I agreed and made the change to the manual that afternoon. In command less than a day, and I'd already exceeded my authority. This one-word administrative change put the chiefs squarely in charge of all aspects of managing their men, including their watch bills, qualification schedules, and training school enrollments. The only way the chiefs could own the leave planning was if they owned the watch bill. The only way they could own the watch bill was if they owned the qualification process. It turned out that managing leave was only the tip of the iceberg and that it rested on a large supporting base of other work. It was hugely powerful. We called it Chiefs in Charge. Because we had just removed a significant amount of the executive officer's authority by eliminating him from the process of signing the enlisted leave chits, I needed to do something to show that I was walking the walk. Therefore, I delegated the control of all officer leave, which I was supposed to sign, to the executive officer. This was consistent with what we'd done with the chiefs, and was also beyond my authority. I wasn't worried about the authority issue, but I was worried about the behavior. If the chiefs continued to be the good guys and approve every leave chit that came their way, the interests of the command would not be protected. As it turns out, however, that didn't happen. Find your organization's genetic code for control. Here's an exercise you can do with your senior leadership at your next offsite. Identify in the organization's policy documents where decision-making authority is specified. You can do this ahead of time if you want. Identify decisions that are candidates for being pushed to the next lower level in the organization. For the easiest decisions, first draft language that changes the person who will have the decision-making authority. In some cases, large decisions may need to be disaggregated. Next, ask each participant in the group to complete the following sentence on the 5x8 card provided. When I think about delegating this decision, I worry that... Post those cards on the wall, go on a long break, and let the group mill around the comments posted on the wall. Last, when the group reconvenes, sort and rank the worries and begin to attack them. When I've conducted this exercise, I usually find that the worries fall into 2 broad categories, issues of competence and issues of clarity. People are worried that the next level down won't make good decisions, either because they lack the technical competence about the subject or because they don't understand what the organization is trying to accomplish. Both of these can be resolved. Find the genetic code and rewrite it is a mechanism for control. The first step in changing the genetic code of any organization or system is delegating control or decision-making authority as much as is comfortable and then adding a pinch more. This isn't an empowerment program. It's changing the way the organization controls decisions in an enduring, personal way. In the example I just shared, there was nothing technically complicated about signing a leave chit. The barriers had to do with trusting that the chiefs understood the goals of Santa Fe the way I did. I call this organizational clarity, or just clarity. I describe this in greater detail in the chapters in Part 4. You tackle it by being honest about what you intend to achieve and communicating that all the time at every level. Many empowerment programs fail because they are just that, programs or initiatives, rather than the central principle, the genetic code, if you will, behind how the organization does business. You can't direct empowerment programs. Directed empowerment programs are flawed because they are predicated on this assumption: I have the authority and ability to empower you, and you don't. Fundamentally, that's disempowering. This internal contradiction dooms these initiatives. We say empowerment, but we do it in a way that is disempowering. The practice outweighs the rhetoric. In a broader sense, this mechanism highlights the point that we didn't give speeches or discuss a philosophical justification for the changes we were going to make. Rather, we searched for the organizational practices and procedures that would need to be changed in order to bring the change to life with the greatest impact. My goal, professionally and personally, was to implement enduring mechanisms that would embed the goodness of the organization and the submarine's people and practices and wouldn't rely on my personality to make it happen. We expanded the power of the chief several times during the 3 years I was on Santa Fe. We started giving them control over their men's leave. The next iteration was to make sure there was a chief who was in charge of every evolution. I wanted to make sure it was clear whenever something happened on the submarine that some chief was responsible for making sure it came out right. The mechanism was to add a line to our planning documents that listed the chief in charge next to each event. I learned that focusing on who was put in charge was more important than trying to evaluate all the ways the event could go wrong. These chiefs in charge initiatives were instrumental in Santa Fe's winning the award for the best chief's quarters for the next 7 years in a row. We discovered that distributing control by itself wasn't enough. As that happened, it put requirements on the new decision makers to have a higher level of technical knowledge and clearer sense of organizational purpose than ever before. That's because decisions are made against a set of criteria that includes what's technically appropriate and what aligns with the organization's interests. In later chapters, you'll be introduced to mechanisms that address both of these supporting pillars. Questions to consider. How can you prepare your mid-level managers to shift from holding a position of privilege to one of accountability, responsibility, and work? What procedure or process can you change with one word that will give your mid-level managers more decision-making authority? When thinking about delegating control, what do you worry about? What do you, as a proponent of the leader-leader approach, need to delegate to show you are willing to walk the talk? Chapter 9. Welcome aboard Santa Fe. Don't like something about the culture in your organization and want to change it? We did this in a simple way. January 11, 1999, Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, 169 days to deployment. The buzz of excitement filled the air on board the USS Santa Fe Monday morning as the chiefs started talking about their new authority. The sailors took notice, and accordingly, there was more spring in their step as we went about the work of the day. It seemed like the direct connection between the chiefs, who were responsible for making the work come out right, and the sailors, who were the performers of the valve lineups, maintenance procedures, and operational tasks, had engaged both the troops and the supervisors alike. There was greater commitment, greater engagement. Military discipline improved as well. In the past, some of the junior enlisted men would mouth off to their chiefs. We called this showing attitude, which is not a good thing. Since each chief's authority to discipline them for their remarks was minimal, these puerile enlisted men could afford to complain. The cost was low. Now, with the chiefs having more authority, the junior enlisted men were motivated to suppress their immature responses and get to the work of the day. So far, so good. Overall, the mood was upbeat. Yet, there was much to do. We were deploying in 169 days. More urgently, prior to deployment, there would be a series of inspections of increasing complexity. We were scheduled to get underway in 8 days to do the first of these, an inspection conducted by my immediate superior, Commodore Mark Kenny. He and his squadron staff were going to be riding us for 4 days, observing Santa Fe perform a host of submarine operations. I wasn't sure how we could possibly do well. The knowledge gaps were so big and the operational practice so rusty, there was no way we could learn and practice everything we needed to in the next week. Besides, we had a full 24/7 job just finalizing the repairs and maintenance from the past month, loading stores, and preparing the charts and operational plan to get underway on time. Not only did we need to demonstrate to the squadron staff that we were competent, we needed a success in support of the changes I needed to make because not everyone understood how this new scheme was going to work. I already had skeptics among the crew. I tried to understand the skeptics' position. One thing that bothered them was that this way of doing business was different from what they had been doing before, on Santa Fe and on every other submarine in the force. There were two components to this. First, many of the chiefs had served on 2, 3, or even 4 submarines. No one else had authorized the chief of the boat to be the final authority on enlisted leave. Heck, they'd never even heard of it. Was it possible that a way of doing business no one had ever heard of could be better than what the Navy had been doing for more than 100 years? It was a legitimate question. Second, there was the fear and cost of being different. Even if we demonstrated that this was a better way, did we want to operate differently from the other 55 nuclear-powered attack submarines in the Navy? Several advisors asked me point-blank if I were willing to take the career risk. Why don't you just be like everyone else? Do the normal things. Build teamwork, enforce standards, conduct training, they'd suggest. If things go well with your new program, great. But if things don't go well, there will be a long line of people saying, well, he did things differently from the rest of us. Chalk it up to being left-handed, perhaps, but I didn't feel any of this fear myself. As I thought about it, pushing authority down could only be good. I remembered how I had felt on board the Sunfish when my commanding officer let me run my own watch team, and how powerful that was. I remembered how I had reverted to top-down leadership on the Will Rogers as well, and how dispiriting that was. Right or wrong, I was committed to doing whatever I thought was best for Santa Fe, the Navy, and the nation without worrying about the repercussions. I called this the paradox of caring but not caring, that is, caring intimately about your subordinates and the organization, but caring little about the organizational consequences to yourself. Despite the skeptics, enough of the team was willing to try our new approach and give me the benefit of the doubt. Some were enthusiastically sold and formed the core of advocates. The skeptics were willing to give it a shot, although less enthusiastically. They weren't going to get in the way. The morning wardroom meeting was my first substantive session with the officers. I had told them to bring all the leave chits they had in their inboxes, and I collected them at the meeting to give them to the Cobb. The pile of unapproved leave chits was significant and provided a physical context for the changes we were making. We had an initiative going for the chiefs, but I wanted to come up with something for the entire ship. The officers would help me craft it. Mechanism: act your way to new thinking. One of the things I heard during my turnover discussions was that they wanted to change the morale among the crew. We invest an average of $50,000 to recruit a sailor, then another $100,000 to train a submarine sailor and give that individual significant responsibility at sea. On board Santa Fe, almost none of the enlisted men had stayed beyond their initial tour of duty. Of a crew of 135, only 3 sailors reenlisted in 1998. 2 of the junior officers, who are trained at an even greater cost, had already submitted their resignations. How do you raise morale quickly? It didn't seem like you could just order a cultural change like this, and yet that's just what we did. I asked the officers how we would know if the crew were proud of the boat. What would we observe? There was silence. Apparently, these officers weren't accustomed to being involved. I pointed my flashlight at one of the junior officers. "You go first," I commanded, and after he spoke, others volunteered their own opinions. They'd brag about it to their family and friends. They'd look visitors in the eye when they met them in the passageway. They'd wear their Santa Fe ball caps as much as possible. They'd boast to their friends on other submarines. They'd buy Santa Fe lighters, pens, and pins from the ship's store. Well, what if we just tell them to act that way, I suggested. What if we just tell them to greet people respectfully, sincerely, and proudly? Could we act or talk our way into a new way of thinking? This sparked a vigorous debate. Some thought that would be like putting the cart before the horse. First, we needed to create a work environment that would give the men respect and dignity, a place they were happy to go each day. Then behavior would change and morale would improve naturally on its own. Others thought we could talk ourselves into it, almost fake it. I decided we would try the route of talking ourselves into a new way of thinking. We called it the three-name rule, and this is how it worked. When any member of the crew saw a visitor on our boat, and we were specifically thinking about the following week when Commodore Kenny and his staff were coming down for the inspection, he was to greet the visitor using three names: the visitor's name, his own name, and the ship's name. For example, "Good morning, Commodore Kenny. My name is Petty Officer Jones. Welcome aboard Santa Fe." On the pier at quarters the next day, I started explaining the three-name rule to the crew. Almost immediately, I stopped. As was normal, the crew stood in formation behind the officers and chiefs, and I knew that most of those in the back couldn't hear what I was saying. I waved my arms and shouted, "Gather round!" It wasn't in the book of commands, but everyone knew what I wanted. The men moved forward. Now I was in a tight and intimate huddle of 100 men. It wasn't something General Patton would have been proud of, but it definitely seemed better. The officers and chiefs were still in front, but because I interacted with that group frequently, I sent them to the back. From that moment on, at quarters, the crew would gather around me and the khakis, officers and chiefs, would stand in back. I went on to tell the crew what we wanted going forward. We had 7 days to finish putting the boat back together and head to sea. We had torpedoes to prepare, maintenance to complete, repairs to finish, charts to prepare, stores to load, and a number of other things to accomplish. So, I resisted giving a big lecture about the reasons why we needed to use the three-name rule and respected their time and their need to get back to work. Instead, I just explained the rule and acted it out. How to embed a cultural change in your organization. Starting condition. You've had a discussion with your leadership group and identified some sort of cultural change the group mostly agrees to. What you want to do now is embed it into the organization independent of personality. Hand out 5x8 cards. Have people complete the following sentence. "I'd know we achieved this cultural change if I saw employees..." The specific wording in the question should move you from general, unmeasurable answers like "have people be creative" to specific, measurable ones like "employees submit at least one idea a quarter. The ideas are posted and other employees can comment on them." Allow 5 minutes. Then tape the cards on the wall, go on break, and have everyone mill around reading the cards. Based on the discussions and quantity of answers, you may want to give everyone a second shot at filling out the cards. Sort and prioritize the answers. Then discuss how to code the behavior into the company's practices, for example, implementing the three-name rule. The final step is to write the new practices into the appropriate company procedure. When you're trying to change employees' behaviors, you have basically two approaches to choose from. Change your own thinking and hope this leads to new behavior, or change your behavior and hope this leads to new thinking. On board Santa Fe, the officers and I did the latter, acting our way to new thinking. We didn't have time to change thinking and let that percolate and ultimately change people's actions. We just needed to change the behavior. Frankly, I didn't care whether people thought differently at some point, and they eventually did, so long as they behaved in certain ways. I think there were likely some sailors who never understood what we were trying to do and resisted the change to leader, but they behaved as if they believed. Some observers attributed the low morale on Santa Fe to the long hours. I didn't think so. I felt it had more to do with focusing on reducing errors instead of accomplishing something great, and the resultant feeling of ineffectiveness that had permeated the ship. The sense on board was that we were not proactive movers, but only passive reactors to external events. The schedule was against us. The parts didn't arrive on time. The detailers didn't give Santa Fe sailors the jobs they wanted. The torpedo missed because of bad luck. There was an emphasis on blaming what was happening on outside influences and factors, and the crew evidenced a collective lack of responsibility. This feeling of victimhood went hand in hand with the low morale. One of the things the three-name rule accomplished was that it got rid of that sense of being victims of our circumstance. In a small way, each sailor on board Santa Fe was now taking charge of his destiny. Acting your way to new thinking is a mechanism for control. Questions to consider. How do you respond when people in your workplace don't want to change from the way things have always been done? What are some of the costs associated with doing things differently in your industry? Do we act first and think later, or do we think first and then change our actions? Chapter 10. Underway on Nuclear Power. Do you play Bring Me a Rock in your organization, where vague understanding of the goal results in wasted time? We did, and we needed to change that. January 20th, 1999, Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, 160 days to deployment. I'd been in command 12 days. The sun was getting low on the horizon as I fidgeted on the bridge of Santa Fe. We were awaiting the clearance message from the maintenance facility that approved the repairs we'd made and authorized us to get underway. That the message was late was our fault. A couple of minor retests had held us up. Nothing as bad as on board the Will Rogers, though. The tugboat was made up alongside. Much longer, and we'd have to delay a day before putting to sea. That would knock out one of our 4 days of preparation before we came in to pick up Commodore Kenny and the inspection team. The speaker on the bridge crackled. Captain, XO, clearance message on board. The officer deck turned to me. Captain, all departments report readiness to get underway. Request permission to get underway. Get underway, I responded. The tug pulled the bow away from the pier, and we silently slipped into the channel and headed to sea. The magic of the moment when the ship has cast off the last lines both to shore and to the tug never loses its potency. That particular moment was no exception. This was great fun. When I gave orders, big things happened. I would say, submerge the ship, and we would dive under the ocean. Ahead flank, and Santa Fe surged through the water. Bring the ship to periscope depth, and officers executed a procedure to safely bring Santa Fe just under the surface of the Pacific Ocean. This was welcome action in contrast to the previous week's trials. In addition to the material issues of putting the boat back together, we had some struggles in preparing ourselves operationally. The crew was still focusing too much on complying with regulations rather than working to make our submarine the most operationally capable warship possible. Perfect, but irrelevant. Nautical charts are the foundation for nuclear submarine operations. They serve as maps showing the routes we must follow to avoid buoys, shallows, and other submarines, while at the same time achieving our operational objectives. In the upcoming exercise, we had to locate an enemy submarine, monitor its activities, and, if directed, sink it. We knew the focus of the operations would be in the Maui Basin, the area between Maui, Lanai, and Molokai. It is an area of shallow water and has an uneven bottom that makes submarining there difficult. Chart preparations consisted of three phases. In phase one, the quartermasters took the large paper charts and made sure they were up to date with information from the latest Coast Guard issued notice to mariners. There might be additional hazards to navigation, such as the setting or moving of a buoy, since the submarine last moved through those areas. In addition, the paper charts had to be prepared according to submarine force instructions, such as highlighting the 100-fathom curve and marking points 10 miles from shoal water and 12 miles from land. Phase 2 consisted of laying out our assigned water. Since submarines are large, quiet objects, we assigned them different blocks of water so they can move safely without fear of collisions. These blocks designate depth zones and geographic zones and change throughout the day and week. It's imperative that these charts be absolutely correct. Otherwise, you might inadvertently operate in water assigned to another submarine, risking collision. If you discovered yourself in this position, you would surface immediately and report the incident. The third, final phase consisted of integrating the operational plan with the chart. This involved laying down a track within the assigned water to accomplish the anticipated mission. This included the specific courses, speeds, and depth zones Santa Fe would use. The charts then went through a laborious review process, starting with the quartermasters who prepared them, and moving up through the assistant navigator, the navigator, Lieutenant Commander Bill Green, and with final approval by the captain, me. In response to a recent navigational problem on another submarine, a force-wide directive had added the executive officer, second in command, to the review process. The Navy commonly added such steps for the force to perform in order to prevent recurrence. Steps are rarely removed. Unfortunately, often these additional steps don't prevent recurrence and sometimes make matters worse. It's like adding inspectors at the end of the process to see if it's gone well. Extra work without making anything better. As the time for underway got closer, I became anxious because I hadn't seen the charts. Bill Green kept telling me they were almost ready. Finally, on Sunday, with underway scheduled for Tuesday, he called me to say he was ready to review the charts. After all those steps in the review process, they were perfect, but irrelevant. The charts were perfect in that they complied with all the rules and regulations. No inspector could have found a deficiency. They were irrelevant because even though the review team factored in where the operational plan had the submarine going, I knew we wouldn't be using the route they proposed. The quartermasters who prepared the charts knew we would end up in the Maui Basin, but they didn't know which of the three paths we'd take to get there, north of Molokai, between Molokai and Lanai, or south of Lanai. They plotted the navigationally better route, which was north of Molokai. This was open water and the fastest route, but it wasn't the way the enemy submarine would go, and hence, wasn't the way we needed to go. None of the reviews up the chain of command noted this problem, because the reviews were all focused on making sure the charts were navigationally and procedurally correct, not on enabling Santa Fe to be an operationally effective warship. In short, the reviews were focused on avoiding errors as opposed to accomplishing something. There was another human tendency working against us as well. Subordinates generally desire to present the boss with a perfect product the first time. Unfortunately, this gets in the way of efficiency because significant effort can be wasted. We decided then and there that at each phase of the review process, the navigator or the assistant navigator should talk to me. These would be quick conversations. On their part, the review team needed to overcome a fear of criticism of an incomplete plan. On my part, I needed to refrain from jumping in with answers. We boiled this down to this motto: a little rudder far from the rocks is a lot better than a lot of rudder close to the rocks. Mechanism: short, early conversations make efficient work. Not everybody liked this idea. Getting me, the boss, involved in the process risked my losing my level of detachment and being less willing to scrap the plan and start over because I had been part of its development. At this point, that was a trade-off I was willing to take because I sensed I needed frequent conversations with all levels of the chain of command to ensure that they were working toward accomplishing operational excellence. Later, once the crew had adopted the new philosophy of achieving operational excellence rather than avoiding errors, I would back out of the process. Beyond this hurdle was another, more basic problem. The charts were inconsistently drawn. On one chart, the 100-fathom curve was highlighted in yellow, on another, red. The young officers responsible for executing the ship's mission, standing watch as officer of the deck, would be presented with different chart legends on different charts and on different days. Yellow would mean something here, something different there. I also imagined running to look at the chart in the middle of the night in a dark control room and not being able to quickly sort out the picture because we hadn't consistently applied color to the charts. These situations spelled nothing but disaster. Angry that the reviews hadn't focused on the right operational goals, I instinctively wanted to grab the executive officer and demand improvement. He'd in turn grab Bill Green, who would grab Chief John Larson and the assistant navigator, and so on. We'd be adhering to the chain of command, but with only 48 hours to get underway, it wouldn't have gotten us ready in time. Further, it would perpetuate the top-down approach I was trying to get away from. Instead, we gathered all the quartermasters to discuss the issues. I thought the junior sailors would be huffy about being called into a big meeting with the captain when all they wanted was to get the work done. I was wrong. I laid out my issues with the charts and how I'd come to the conclusions I came to. One of the junior quartermasters, recently qualified to stand watch, was a stocky African-American we called Sled Dog because he would work till he dropped. If you just met him walking through the ship, you would have guessed he was an auxiliaryman, not a quartermaster. To my surprise, Sled Dog immediately perked up and began offering suggestions. He had clearly been frustrated, toiling away in the dark. Now he had a voice. It was a classic case of the workers being technically competent but unclear about what we were trying to achieve. This inefficient work practice was the antithesis of what we were going to do, and I was glad to have this insight. When asked about the significance of the different colors chosen for the contour lines, Sled Dog frankly admitted that the curves were highlighted simply based on what colored markers were available at the time. I wanted the colors to be consistent and to convey information. Someone suggested that we use a modified National Geographic scheme. Shades of red would represent shallow water, shades of blue, deeper water. We also came up with standard schemes for water assignments. Santa Fe's water would always be blue in military exercises. American forces were always blue. Other submarines would be yellow. Areas where we shared water but were separated by depth zone would be, you guessed it, green. A quick look at the chart, and each officer of the deck would know instantly that if it was blue, Santa Fe owned the water. If it was yellow, we needed to stay out, and if it was green, we needed to maintain a specific depth zone. This worked because the display conventions in efficient symbology and coloring tapped a much larger body of knowledge in your brain. It built on what you already knew. The book to read on this subject is Edward Tufte's The Visual Display of Quantitative Information. We tried the changes, and after agreeing that they made sense, Bill Green wrote our new procedures up in the standing orders. This is where excellence in navigation occurred, and where excellence in combat effectiveness started. Short, early conversations is a mechanism for control. It is a mechanism for control because the conversations did not consist of me telling them what to do. They were opportunities for the crew to get early feedback on how they were tackling problems. This allowed them to retain control of the solution. These early, quick discussions also provided clarity to the crew about what we wanted to accomplish. Many lasted only 30 seconds, but they saved hours of time. A commanding officer's attention is no doubt highly valuable time for the organization, and the hierarchy was supposed to protect that time. Inefficiencies in my time were highly visible, especially to me. Less visible, however, were the inefficiencies of all the people throughout the organization. In my organization, even accounting for the difference in the value of our time, those inefficiencies overwhelmingly outweighed whatever efficiency I was getting with my time as captain. Furthermore, supervisors needed to recognize that the demand for perfect products the first time they see them results in significant waste and frustration throughout their organization. Even a 30-second check early on could save your people numerous hours of work. Many, many times I'd be walking around the boat and ask someone, "Show me what you're working on," only to discover that a well-meaning yet erroneous translation of intent was resulting in a significant waste of resources. Don't you trust me? One problem that came up as we spread the idea of these short interactions early in the process was the question of trust. I could hear the petty officers complaining that the command didn't trust them, and sometimes they challenged me directly with that complaint. For a long time, this bothered me, because I actually did trust them, but I didn't know how to answer the question. Then I realized that we were talking about two totally different things. Trust means this. When you report that we should position the ship in a certain position, you believe we should position the ship as you indicated. Not trusting you would mean that I thought you might be saying one thing while actually believing something else. Trust is purely a characteristic of the human relationship. Now, whether the position you indicate is actually the best tactical position for Santa Fe is a totally different issue, one of physics, time, distance, and the movements of the enemy. These are characteristics of the physical world and have nothing to do with trust. Questions to consider. How would you counter any reluctance on the part of your team to have early, quick discussions with you, the boss, to make sure projects are on course? To what degree is trust present in your organization? Is your staff spending time and money creating flawless charts and reports that are, simultaneously, irrelevant? What can you do in your organization to add a little rudder far from the rocks to prevent needing a lot of rudder next to the rocks? What commonplace facts can you leverage to make information more valuable and accessible to your employees? Have you ever uncovered a reason why, akin to Sled Dog's admission that the navigational chart legends depended on whatever color highlighter was at the ready? Chapter 11, I Intend To. How proactive are senior managers and employees in your organization? Rewording our speech dramatically changed our level of proactivity. January 21st, 1999, Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, 159 days to deployment. Comm maneuvering, reactor scram. The reactor had just shut down. The engineer inserted the shutdown deliberately, testing his department's ability to find and repair a simulated fault. The 4 days we had to regain our sea legs until we picked up Commodore Mark Kenny were jammed with training, qualification checkouts, strike exercises, and torpedo loading events. After picking up the inspection team, we would hunt for an enemy submarine heading toward Maui, where we'd shoot some exercise torpedoes against all the targets we were assigned. It would be fun, but I was nervous about how the ship would do. It was going to be our first big test. Inspection mentality is a morale killer. This is the practice of focusing solely on the next inspection. While many ships gear their efforts toward doing well on the next inspection, on some ships this inspection mentality is so strong they refer to ORS patrols and TREE patrols. The Operational Reactor Safeguards Examination, ORS, is a propulsion plant exam, and so they run predominantly engineering drills. The Tactical Readiness Evaluation, TREE, involves challenging navigation drills, as well as shooting missiles and torpedoes, so they run predominantly forward drills. On Santa Fe, doing well on inspections was going to be the natural outcome of being excellent, not the goal. Operational and tactical excellence and preparedness for service to the country were what mattered. If we were excellent and prepared, the drills and inspections would take care of themselves. We were about to do a tactical inspection, so it was natural that the weapons officer, Lieutenant Dave Adams, had packed the schedule with weapons and tactical training. The engineer, Lieutenant Commander Rick Panlilio, wanted to do this engineering drill, and that seemed like a good idea to me because we needed to train both ends of the ship, the tactical end and the propulsion end. I'm glad I agreed to include such a drill because I learned a lesson of profound significance, both to me and to the future of Santa Fe. The drill was simple. The engineer would shut down the reactor with a simulated fault. The engineering department would troubleshoot to locate the problem, conduct the necessary repairs, and restart the reactor. While the reactor was shut down, we would have to shift propulsion from the large steam-powered main engines to a much smaller electric propulsion motor called the EPM. The EPM can power the ship only at slow speed, but it's enough to get you home if the reactor is out of commission. We set up for the drill. I was in the control room in the forward part of the submarine, observing the officer of the deck and the ship control watchstanders. In the engine room, Rick and his drill team set up and had started the drill by scramming, shutting down, the reactor. The officer of the deck was my senior department head, Lieutenant Commander Bill Green, and he was doing all the right things. We had shifted propulsion from the main engines to an auxiliary electric motor, the EPM, to turn the propeller. The officer of the deck was my senior department head, Lieutenant Commander Bill Green, and he was doing all the right things. We had shifted propulsion from the main engines to an auxiliary electric motor, the EPM, to turn the propeller. The ship was coming shallow in order to use its diesel engine to provide electrical power and keep the battery charged until the reactor was restarted. During the long troubleshooting period, while the nuclear electronics technicians were isolating the fault, I started to get bored. I fiddled with my flashlight, turning it on and off. Things were going too smoothly, and I couldn't let the crew think their new captain was easy. I nudged Bill and suggested we increase speed from ahead one-third to ahead two-thirds on the EPM to give the nuclear-trained enlisted men, nukes, more to worry about. This would significantly increase the rate of battery discharge and put pressure on the troubleshooters to find and correct the fault quickly. At ahead two-thirds, there's a near-continuous click-click-click-click-click on the battery amp-hour meter, an audible reminder that time is running out. It's physically unnerving. "Ahead two-thirds," he ordered. Nothing happened. The helmsman should have reached over and rung up ahead two-thirds. Instead, I could see him squirming in his chair. No one said anything, and several awkward seconds passed. Astutely noting that the order hadn't been carried out, I asked the helmsman what was going on. He was facing his panel, but reported over his shoulder, "Captain, there is no ahead two-thirds on the EPM." Now, here's my excuse. As I've mentioned in an earlier chapter, I had not been on this class submarine before, and every ship I had been on previously had one-third and two-thirds on the EPM. I'm 100% sure that somewhere in being trained for my new submarine, this fact had been covered, but it didn't stick amid the myriad technical details. I'd fallen back on what I'd known before. I applauded the helmsman and grabbed Bill. In the corner of the control room, I asked him if he knew that there was no ahead two-thirds on the EPM. "Yes, Captain, I did." "Well, why did you order it?" I asked, astounded. "Because you told me to." "What? I thought you learned something secret at prospective commanding officer school that they only tell the commanding officers about." He was being perfectly honest. By giving that order, I took the crew right back to the top-down command and control leadership model. That my most senior, experienced officer of the deck would repeat it was a giant wake-up call about the perils of that model for something as complicated as a submarine. What happens in a top-down culture when the leader is wrong? Everyone goes over the cliff. I vowed henceforth never to give an order any order. I would let this be a lesson to myself to keep my mouth shut. This incident brought to mind being chided as an officer of the deck on my first submarine, the USS Sunfish, when I asked the captain for permission. "Just tell me what you're going to do," he exclaimed. Thereafter, I started saying, "Captain, I intend to," and he encouraged it. That's what we decided to do on Santa Fe. It wasn't just when you were on watch. It wasn't just for officers. It started filtering through the crew and permeating the way we did business. For my part, I would avoid giving orders. Officers would state their intentions with, "I intend to," and I would say, "Very well." Then each man would execute his plan. Mechanism: use "I intend to" turn passive followers into active leaders. "I intend to" was an incredibly powerful mechanism for control. Although it may seem like a minor trick of language, we found that it profoundly shifted ownership of the plan to the officers. "I intend to" didn't take long to catch on. The officers and crew loved it. I was the only one who had a problem with it, ironically. I was worried that someone would say, "I intend to," when I was sleeping, and I would not be fully informed or understand what was happening. So we made a rule that "I intend to" only applied when I was awake. Other than that, it applied to everything. A year later, I was standing on the bridge of Santa Fe with Dr. Stephen Covey. He'd heard what we were doing and was interested in riding a submarine. Commodore Mark Kenny had been instrumental in arranging it. By this point, the crew had fully embraced our initiatives for control, and "I intend to" was prominently visible. Throughout the day, officers approached me with "I intend to." "Captain, I intend to submerge the ship. We are in water we own. Water depth has been checked and is 400 feet. All men are below, the ship is rigged for dive, and I've certified my watch team." "Very well." Dr. Covey was keenly interested in how the ship operated. I gave a copy of his book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People to every chief and officer who reported aboard Santa Fe. We were applying many of the ideas in his book at an organizational level to great success. The power of words. The key to your team becoming more proactive rests in the language subordinates and superiors use. Here is a short list of disempowered phrases that passive followers use. Request permission to, I would like to, what should I do about, do you think we should, could we? Here is a short list of empowered phrases that active doers use. I intend to, I plan on, I will, we will. Interested readers will want to check out Stephen Covey's The Eighth Habit for more ideas about the value of empowering language. Then, we extended the concept. Frequently, I wouldn't just say very well. There would be too many unanswered questions about the safety and appropriateness of the proposed event, so I found myself asking a bunch of questions. One day, I caught myself, and instead of asking the questions I had in mind, I asked the officer of the deck what he thought I was thinking about his I intend to submerge. Well, Captain, I think you're wondering if it's safe and appropriate to submerge. Correct. So why don't you just tell me why you think it is safe and appropriate to submerge? All I'll need to say is very well. Thereafter, the goal for the officers would be to give me a sufficiently complete report so that all I had to say was a simple approval. Initially, they would provide some information, but not all. Most of the time, however, they had the answers. They just hadn't vocalized them. Eventually, the officers outlined their complete thought processes and rationale for what they were about to do. The benefit from this simple extension was that it caused them to think at the next higher level. The officers of the deck needed to think like the captain, and so on down the chain of command. In effect, by articulating their intentions, the officers and crew were acting their way into the next higher level of command. We had no need of leadership development programs. The way we ran the ship was the leadership development program. One of the mechanisms I credit for the significantly disproportionate number of promotions that have been issued among Santa Fe's officer and crew in the past decade was our I intend to procedure. Eventually, we turned everything upside down. Instead of one captain giving orders to 134 men, we would have 135 independent, energetic, emotionally committed, and engaged men thinking about what we needed to do and ways to do it right. This process turned them into active leaders as opposed to passive followers. Later, I had the opportunity to talk with a friend of mine who had taught the prospective commanding officer class. He was frustrated by the inability of too many officers in the training pipeline who were almost ready to be promoted to commanding officers to make decisions at the captain level. He said that these officers came from good ships, but would be paralyzed when it came to decision-making. I took issue with his categorizing them as good ships. By using that term, he meant ships that didn't have problems, at least that he knew about. But this had obviously been accomplished using a top-down leader-follower structure where the captain, when these officers were second in command, made the decisions. Moreover, it didn't appear that the captain had sufficiently trained or involved his executive officer. This shows the degree to which we reward personality-centered leadership structures and accept their limitations. These may have been good ships in that they avoided problems, but they certainly did not have good leadership. Why did I say to the navigator that he should go ahead 2/3 on the EPM? Being the captain of a nuclear-powered submarine can be a tremendous rush. You give orders, people jump, the reactor goes to higher power, the submarine surges through the water. You want more, you give more orders, and you become more controlling. It has a seductive pull on the leaders, but it is debilitating and energy-sapping for the followers. Questions to consider. What causes us to take control when we should be giving control? Can you recall a recent incident where your subordinate followed your order because he or she thought you had learned secret information for executives only? What would be the most challenging obstacle to implementing I intend to in your place of business? Could your mid-level managers think through and defend their plan of action for the company's next big project?